RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Okay, already we're up to episode 5 in our series, which has been on, well, for the last now 5 weeks on RCR with Joel Robinson of Radical Investments in Wellington. What is money? Boy, it seems like we just had episode 1 only, I don't know, it doesn't seem like 5 weeks,
Joel. A couple of days ago.
Yeah, things have moved quick. It's been fascinating. We started off with the history of money. Then we went through how currency works, stores of money, into banking, then sort of nudging into digital. But this is where the rubber hits the road now in the future.
Yes.
So episode 5, we're going to do this in 2 parts, is the Bitcoin discussion. So how do you want to lead off? Bit of history. I mean, people are aware kind of how Bitcoin came about. I'm in that category. But maybe we could start off there and then linking up some dots from there.
Yeah, I think it would definitely be good to give a bit of a background to Bitcoin, how it works. And people can then, I guess, have a bit of an idea of where the rest of the conversation has led to and how it fits. Because so often the conversations I've had with people on this topic, they're coming at it from a completely different angle, and I think they're coming at it from the wrong angle. In the investment world, so I'm actually going way off what I was planning to talk about here, but I think this is actually really, really worthwhile, in that often I have a conversation with people in the investment world, a lot of investment analysts, who try and value it like they would value a company. But what Bitcoin isn't is a company. It's not a company. The point or the value behind it is to be a currency. And you don't value a currency the same way you value a company. So they start with the wrong lens. It's like they've got the wrong pair of glasses on and trying to analyze what it is.
Yeah.
The other is people approach it from like a very tech focused avenue, where they look at Bitcoin and all the other cryptocurrencies and they say that Bitcoin is inferior because it's not the most efficient, not the most energy efficient as a common one.
Oh, but actually, you mean the power generation and everything that goes into making and mining them?
Yeah, which we'll talk to actually, because there's often some misquoted things here about, you know, so-called energy wastage. But actually, the truth is very different. But the key thing is they often kind of get focused on the tech side. Oh, there's these other cryptocurrencies that are, you know, faster or better designed. But actually, there are some key things that they're missing, which even gives credence to Bitcoin as being a thing in the first place. And that's right. All back to those issues of centralization versus decentralization, etc. So anyway, to jump back into the Bitcoin lens. So it all started with a guy called Satoshi Nakamoto, who is this pseudonym. And there's been all sorts of news articles on who this really is and what's happened to him. And is it actually someone from Japan, as the name would indicate? And all of this, and HBO just recently, you know, put this documentary out talking about it being this guy, Peter Todd, who was quite involved with Bitcoin in sort of early days, and he's denied it, and other people have claimed
it. Is he the Aussie guy?
No, he's not. There was an Aussie guy who did claim himself that he was the creator, and that was debunked. So there's been, you know, all sorts of claims. But
typical Australian move, eh?
Not just the Aussies. There's a couple of Americans that were the same and claiming it was them. So I don't know. Do we put the Aussies and the Americans?
Was
in the
like
same
the underarm bowling, famous underarm bowling incident. Okay, so we don't quite know who Satoshi Nakamoto is.
No, but yeah, he or she or them could have been multiple people, really. Yeah, I mean, who knows? It's I think it's something that will be forever debated until someone is able to move the original Bitcoin that was created by Satoshi Nakamoto, because it's held in a wallet. And the thing is, it's publicly viewable. You can see this balance, so people can know if it's moved or not. And it hasn't ever. It's just sat there. So the minute someone moves it, then people go, okay, well, that person that created it is still alive, but it's never moved.
Because only they could move it.
Well, because they are the only ones that basically control the password to it or the credentials needed to be able to access it and move it. And if you don't have that password, then it just sits there forever. And it could
Everyone loves a story, Joel. Mm. Everyone loves a story. And part of the mystique of this is part of the story, is part of, I would say, authenticity equals value eventually.
Yes. Well, Yeah, it's the only cryptocurrency where there is this kind of pseudonymous creation. Every other one has been created by a person or a company or a group of people. This is the only one where it's really, truly pseudonymous. Additionally, because it was the first proper cryptocurrency, it's just added and surrounded to the intrigue of it. So
it was launched in 2009, I believe.
Yes.
But I wonder how much advanced thinking in terms of years went into it before the actual launch.
Would have been a lot. We didn't really touch on this during the series so far, but there were various different attempts at cryptocurrencies. Like there was an e-gold that was tried and failed. There were various attempts, but none of them could quite adequately answer all of the issues that really needed to be addressed for it to work. And I guess the classic one is, with the internet, anytime you send something, you're basically making a copy of it. If I send you an email and I send you a copy of like a document, something that happens in my line plenty.
It's not the same atoms that turn up. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. You have a copy of the document, and I still have the copy as well. And so because of that, currency to date, anytime you've had digital involvement with currency, especially, with fiat currency, there has to be some intermediary involved that you're placing some trust in, because otherwise you're effectively creating a copy of what you're sending, and there's no way that you can have certainty that that person doesn't go and just spend that money before you receive it. And so having the intermediary person that takes hold of it and then, releases it or sends it on once something has been received in exchange for the money, or just immediately, and there's trust that the thing will be delivered. But there's always an intermediary. Until
the banks.
Yeah, banks, payment processors, get the whole SWIFT system. Yeah, there's a huge variety of different intermediaries. I mean, you think of your likes of Visa and MasterCard, we're all very familiar with. Yeah. They're one of many often in that chain. I mean, so there's not often just one intermediary, it's often multiple. So Bitcoin really was the first true creation that was a form of money that it allowed there to be no intermediary, truly peer-to-peer digital payment. I mean, you can have peer-to-peer physical cash. That's always been a thing.
Yeah, handing it over.
Exactly. But you can't do that if you're transacting with someone that lives in the UK from New Zealand.
Yeah.
Unless
Without
you fly there
knowing
yourself.
For sure, it's not a duplication or a copy. Yeah,
exactly. Okay. Or mailing the physical cash, but it obviously has some pretty big risks in itself. And
good
it's
luck
very
with
slow.
That. Yeah. You see postal workers holding it up to the light at every stop.
There's pretty obvious reasons why we don't do that. So, I guess how Bitcoin works is probably pretty helpful. So it is a publicly immutable ledger. That's probably the best way to describe it. So much of how it's been unpacked or how we look at it is this coin, right? Because when it comes to like news media and wanting to have an image, it's difficult to create an image of something that doesn't really have much of a physical image. Like it's literally just, code. And so often there's this, coin, because we're familiar with coins and the whole B with the kind of lines through it, like you have on the dollar
sign. I've seen that one.
It's used a lot, but there's no actual, that's not like built into the ledger itself. That's, it's just a kind of a representation that's grown because.
Like a logo.
It's like a logo. A logo that's kind of organically developed by the community that's really involved with Bitcoin, and has kind of just become adopted because there's not really any big loss if the logo changes. Basically, it's kind of not attached to the
value. That's another interesting thing, because normally, branding of something is so essential to acceptance by an audience or a marketplace. Here, you don't even need the branding.
Yeah, well, it's just, I guess, because the design is so unique, so profound, that is
genius.
Essentially sufficient for the it's not been fast in some ways it has been fast, but we're now 15 years down the track of the life of Bitcoin, and well, actually it's a little bit longer than that in reality, but in the sort of publicly traded life of Bitcoin, and it doesn't happen instantly overnight. But so what was unique about it, able to be a ledger that doesn't require having a trusted intermediary. And so, what it really is basically just like, if you imagine a book with a lot of lines, and there's 21 million lines in that book, each Bitcoin is essentially a line in that book. It's a ledger that everyone can view and requires the coordination of the whole network to verify who owns what. So it's built on the high focus on verification and almost zero need for trust.
Well, I just got a question on that. So let's say I had a whole bunch of Bitcoins in my dreams.
Yep.
Let's say I had a Bitcoin. I might be El Salvador and I'm buying one every day or week. I don't think that'll ever happen. Can people go in and see how many I've got and which ones belong to me and can work out my holding from that?
Correct.
Wow.
If they know what address belongs to who.
Okay, how is that information? Is that available?
Well, anyone can view, with the right tools, they can view the different addresses out there what each address owns.
Yeah.
And basically over time, especially for those that are larger, you can kind of put two and two together.
Work out who belongs to what address. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially like at the really large end, you know, talking about governments, like, you know, when you get to those addresses that own huge amounts of Bitcoin, the list of potential people that could be really, really narrows down. Whereas your average person owning 0.001 Bitcoin can effectively be anyone. So yeah, it's like email addresses is the best way to give a simple analogy. So your Bitcoin address is like your email address. You can make that publicly available. Lots of people cannot. Whether everyone knows who Joel at Radical Investment is depends on how publicly, you know, I make that email address or how publicly available I make it. These addresses, there's nothing in the address itself that includes people's names or anything. It's a bunch of numbers and letters. But, you know, I could go and publish, you know, my public key, as it's called, which is equivalent to my email address. But I'm not going to go publishing my private key, which is the equivalent of the password to your email. So in order to send something from there, you need, obviously, to access the email, which requires a password. And you need the email address or the public address of the person to send it to. But nobody can go and access that Bitcoin without having the private key, aka
okay.
the equivalent of your email password.
So the public key allows the exchange.
Yep.
But the private key is all the deets of who owns it and all of that.
The private key is what each is unique to each individual public key, and there's something that you shouldn't share with anyone.
Right.
Because that's the keys to the key.
To the money.
that's the password to accessing and to having control of that. That money.
I'm so curious about the mining of it too. I hope you don't mind thinking or talking about that because, you know, we touched on it at the start, you know, energy consumption. You can imagine all these power stations kind of unplugging the aluminium smelter and plugging it into one of these things to make it work. So what is the process? Why is it so difficult? They need, huge amounts of computing power, and NVIDIA has done well out of this. So what's all that about, the mining of Bitcoin?
Yeah, so how it works is basically in the Bitcoin network, it's made up of a bunch of nodes. Nodes being individual points, computers, for lack of a better description. Each node that is participating in the mining process, which I'll unpack a bit, what it is doing is crunching some very difficult equations, very complex equations that are mathematical. And so they're expending a lot of power to solve these equations. You know, a bit tougher than your 2 plus 2. What does 2 plus 2 equal?
Okay. So mega numbers, basically, number combinations
mega numbers. And it's built into the design of Bitcoin itself, is built in this mechanic of mining. And a really fascinating, unique feature of it is it doesn't matter how much power is expended. If the rate of creation of new Bitcoin starts to increase beyond the designed rate, so it's designed that a new block of transactions should be created every 10 minutes.
The
design. If it starts being quicker than that, every 2 weeks there is an adjustment that's happening where it increases the difficulty of the equations to make it tougher. So it's like the equivalent of a, you know, we see the Reserve Bank making changes to the OCR to make money easier or, you know, more or less available effectively. What it's essentially doing is doing this with perfect information and perfect accuracy and without any emotion.
Yeah.
No subjectivity.
Yeah.
It's if the new creation has gone beyond what it should, well, it increases the difficulty. And if it drops below again, well, the difficulty drops below again. And so if Bitcoin were to massively drop off in usage and the mining as a result dropped off, then the difficulty would massively decrease as well.
Okay.
And it has proven a very, very effective mechanism that has pretty much perfectly operated as was designed. If you look at the amount of power that's been expended.
Must be a mathematician who thought of it then.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, it's cryptography. If you've seen the Imitation Game, I believe it was, with Benedict Cumberbatch talking about...
Was it the unpicking of the Enigma?
Yes. There's all sorts of cryptography is basically what they're doing. And this is essentially an advanced form of that using computers. So, yeah, the amount of power that's being expended here is enormous, which is also a part of what makes Bitcoin secure. The more power that's expended, the tougher and tougher it is to...
Yeah, but the value goes up too, right?
To crack. Yeah, and so the value goes up essentially as a result of how difficult it is.
Yeah. And, yeah, and being a node, quick question. Being a node, so obviously you'd have to run software that governs the process. Yes. So you've got to sign up and qualify for that. Then you've got to
connect to a network.
Yeah. Okay. Then you've got to invest in the capital equipment to do the mining, and that and that won't be cheap, right? I mean,
that's a
high bar to get in. Number one, and then you're basically controlled by the. I get algorithms or mathematical combinations, you'd have to be certain that it's going to work to get into that game.
You would. But early days, the cost of involvement was so low because there were so few people involved. It was more just a point of intrigue.
Yeah.
I mean, early on, there was, it took a while for there to be the first sale of Bitcoin. The first sale of Bitcoin occurred in October 2009. And it was effectively 0.00099 US dollars per coin.
Okay.
So
that's talking smaller than nothing. Yeah.
Minute cost. So really it was kind of just a hobby project for those first people that got involved and thought, oh, this is interesting. And you could have done it on your laptop. Whereas now, because there's far more competition, because there is the incentive of the block reward. So every 10 minutes when that block is created, the first node to solve the equation correctly earns a block reward.
Okay, so there's
some new Bitcoin.
Widened competitiveness.
There is. Yep.
Oh, this is a genius thing.
And then, interestingly enough, and this is a whole kind of another field of itself, but it is possible for a fairly basic piece of mining equipment or a basic, well, not so much a basic computer, but a central basic special computer, to call it that.
Yeah, with the right
it is possible
processor in
for
it.
An individual to be the one that gets that equation first. It doesn't happen too often.
Yeah.
But it does happen occasionally, and sometimes it's a bit of news in the Bitcoin
community. So a wild card factor as well.
Yeah, exactly. So if you could have been someone that forked out $20,000 on this machine, and you managed to be the one to verify the block. And your block reward is worth more than what you paid.
They presumably have got the value from that. So stuff that, or bitcoins that didn't cost much to mine then are now worth what
if they
held them. Yeah, well, some probably
Which
will.
Is the key thing.
Yeah.
A lot of them don't. I've had a lot of stories of people that accidentally threw hard drives away, which I think I alluded to in an earlier
previous that'd kill you.
Podcast. There was a guy in the UK who threw it away and was prepared to pay like $4 million or something to
recover,
basically all of the rubbish and go through it
the landfill.
Piece by piece.
Yeah.
Because what he had was worth sort of $10 million, and he was saying, I'm happy to stump it up. And he had some loans arranged and all sorts, but they wouldn't let him.
Well, maybe it's a good time to talk about the value, the increasing value over the time. Okay, so 0.000994 USD. Launch October 2009. Take us through the milestones of value.
May 2010 was a famous date in Bitcoin lore, it was the first transaction of Bitcoin being used to pay for something. And someone spent 10,000 Bitcoin on two pizzas in the States. If you look at the price of Bitcoin now, and you think about 10,000 of that.
That's like 6.4 mil, isn't it?
It's a little bit more than that.
64 million, maybe.
It was a pretty expensive pizza.
They probably thought they were getting a good deal back in the day.
Well, at the time it priced Bitcoin at basically a quarter of a cent per Bitcoin.
Right.
Effectively.
Gee.
But crazily, only about a year and a bit later, the price peaked at $21 US per coin. It's an enormous growth,
right?
And that, yep. And that space of time,
it's double the growth, isn't it?
Much more than that. Yeah. And it's from quarter of a cent to $21.
Oh, right. Okay. You see why I never invented anything like this. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So that's like the inflation of the universe kind of scale.
Only 13 months apart. Yeah. So the pizza is kind of forever linked to Bitcoin and law. So often there's Bitcoin pizza parties that are held on certain events because it's now just a part of the story of Bitcoin. That pizza was kind of it's kind of ironic and perhaps appropriate that something is kind of, you know, mundane and common life as a pizza, a takeaway pizza was, you know, it's such an integration with the story of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you say, what's that in pizzas? Yeah. Okay, so the growth has been phenomenal. And if you look at, it went through, $1,000 a Bitcoin in 2013.
Yep.
And 9 years later, looking at these stats, it's off the planet compared to how it started.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, huge change, huge, huge change. And that came with greater adoption. More adoption meant, more people prepared to pay for it and realizing what it represented. I think perhaps the designer of it, I mean, Satoshi mentioned in one of the white papers, the sort of early documents around the creation of it, that it was basically out of a dissatisfaction with what occurred following the GFC.
Yeah.
Mm. And how essentially no bankers faced any real
I like it. So
what had happened.
Ethical sort of response to a criminal behavior, perhaps.
Yep. It was a dissatisfaction with kind of what was going on with money and could quite possibly be a very good answer to that because it's decentralized by nature, Bitcoin. It's basically uncensorable. There is potential to kind of influence the on and off ramps into Bitcoin, but there is essentially nothing that can stop one person sending Bitcoin to another person as long as they both have control. Well, as that person sending has control of that address.
Can you send fractions of a Bitcoin though? Because you know I don't want to always be looking for something that's $64,000 worth every time I want to spend a Bitcoin.
Correct. Well, it wouldn't really work. That wouldn't actually be a functional or feasible form of payment if you couldn't. So yeah, they're fractional down to 100 million satoshis as they're known, which is an ode to the creator. So it's the smallest decimal being one with eight zeros in front of a Bitcoin. So it allows for huge fractionality. And today's dollars, it's much, much less than a cent, New Zealand. So it allows for really huge fractionality, which is obviously, harking back to some of our discussion on what makes good money, a really important point. So right now, Bitcoin meets some of the criteria for what makes good money, but not all of it. But there's some clear and I think very reasonable arguments as to why it will start to meet some of these other things. And one of the big parts of what we talked about as a core function of money is that medium exchange. It's something for money has to be a medium exchange. And one of those is that the money isn't acquired for its own sake. Currently, Bitcoin is definitely acquired for its own sake. But as something becomes more and more adopted, it also loses a lot of that potential for there being significant gain out of it. Because if everyone's using it, it's kind of reached its peak adoption. So there's not that same ability for growth. And at that point, it actually becomes much better as a currency. Because as you see something scale in use, the volatility and its value drops off massively. We look at currencies, US dollar, New Zealand dollar, not so much. It's perhaps a bit biased because we're in New Zealand, but the US dollar, highly used. Yes, there is some level of volatility compared to other currencies, but the volatility is much less than Bitcoin. And as it grows in scale, volatility day to day should be much less. We see it in the stock market too. Companies that are much smaller, that are less used, less bought and sold, they tend to have more volatility day to day in their share price compared to ones that are, at the larger end. And it's actually playing out that way. If you look, I mean, it's quite a choppy chart, but if you look at the directional trend of the volatility in Bitcoin over sort of 12-month timeframes, it is actually reducing over time, that level of volatility. And so I think if adoption continues to go in the direction it's headed, that volatility and value will start to significantly drop off.
And it's global. It's global too, right? It can be used anywhere. That's another big thing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and kind of on that tangent, it's technically galactic.
Yeah.
Really? It's plausibly galactic.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if humans go to Mars, whether we end up, you know, living there or just, you know, Elon Musk decides to take a holiday there, at the end of the day, are we going to be taking territorially bound currencies outside the Earth? It's not really going to make much sense. It's probably not going to be US dollars, New Zealand dollars, Australian dollars. Gold's too heavy to transport in a rocket. Yeah.
Turning up with cash.
Yeah. And so something that's, you know, digital, when it comes to scalability, which is another one of those key characteristics of what makes good currency, with Bitcoin, you know, it's effectively weightless because it's stored digitally. The ability for it to be transported is fantastic, and the ability for it to be stored over time is fantastic as well, because, you know, you can store it on a digital wallet, which can be something physical, and, you know, you can just not have that connected to the Bitcoin network, have it sat there, and it sits there for as long as the thing you have it stored on survives, basically. So there's a huge potential for it to essentially not tarnish or wear over time because it is digital code.
Yeah, but what happens, and this is the great weakness, isn't it? What happens if these networks don't work sometime? Or something happens that takes a good deal of them out, then where are Bitcoin holders left?
Well, for it to be taken out, every single node in the network would have to be down. And that's actually a very tough thing to do. And to date, there's not been an event where that's happened. So that is one of the potential risks that we can dive into a little bit as we go through some of the questions and some of the, you know, potential back and forth with part two next week. But yeah, that is one of the risks. But to date, there's not been nothing that has taken it down entirely. When China actually banned outright Bitcoin mining, what we saw was the power usage used in Bitcoin mining fell off quite a lot. But it basically just was completely replaced within, I think it was 2 or 3 months, in just other parts of the world.
Okay.
And so,
yeah,
in order for Bitcoin to have a real weakness and be susceptible to attack, you'd have to simultaneously have a huge chunk of the network basically going down completely, while at the same time a huge amount of power being utilized by one entity acting in concert to effectively fraudulently create transactions in the blockchain for Bitcoin in order to really undermine the trust in it. Take an incredibly coordinated and expensive effort for that to be possible. And I'm doubtful as to whether that would be able to be achieved. But yeah, that's where some of the critics would perhaps come from.
Nuclear war?
Yeah, plausible. But again,
asteroid, you know, hit.
Well, the Bitcoin itself can still, you know, can be stored on devices
remote,
you know, would survive through nuclear war. Hmm. So, I mean, the holder, you know, might die, and the passcode might as well. But for as long as Bitcoin is kind of being fed, it's almost like a virus in a way. For as long as it's being fed, it continues to live on. If the whole world was, just effectively destroyed in nuclear war, we'd probably have bigger issues.
Yeah,
and
like,
your form of money probably becomes
Bitcoin. My Bitcoin.
Tin cans.
Forget everything
you're
else.
Thinking about, probably. People would be trading probably tin soup. Tin tomatoes.
Back to tomatoes. That's
medicine.
Where we started.
Back to tomatoes, yeah. And, anything that has, you know, food, shelter.
Yeah, of course.
Probably weapons.
Yeah.
We talked
definitely
about
weapons
as well.
Yeah.
I tell you, in that instance, you know, fiat currency is definitely going to have no value.
No one's thinking about money per se. Okay, well, we're coming up against time, so we're going to have a part two of this talk about Bitcoin. What are we going to be finding out next Monday, Joel?
Yeah, so we'll probably cover off a little bit of the other elements here that we didn't get time for that I think would be really helpful for people to know. And I think it would be really cool. So for those that are listening, if you've got some questions related to this, send them through to RCR and we can coordinate and talk through some of those
great
questions.
Great idea. Great. We'll do that for sure. All right. Well, that went quickly. Fascinating as always.
Good.
Episode 5 of What Is Money? We'll do episode 6. I'm good with the basic maths, you see, Joel. Next Monday. Fantastic. Until then, Joel Robinson from Radical Investment. Thanks for coming in, Joel. We'll talk again in a week.
My pleasure, Paul. Thanks very much.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.